step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games that's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
A juror swore under oath that the Colleton County Clerk of Court made her feel like Alec Murdaugh was guilty before deliberations even started. She had doubts. She voted to convict anyway. Former Chief Justice Jean Toll heard all of it and ruled that's not quite enough. She punted it down to the South Carolina Supreme Court. And, well, that game just ended. And the score is 5-0. And Alec Murdaugh won. Not a close call at all. But on who carries the burden of proof? It's going to happen. Alec Murdaugh is 99.9% likely to get a new trial. We're here to talk about that in three different segments this morning. We're going to dive into how Alec Murdaugh is getting a new trial, the logistics that put us here, what may still stand from the first trial, because it's not always just a carbon copy repeat, and this is not going to be the same thing here either, and what new elements may come in, and how the retrial is going to be different. We're going to get into all of that this morning. Here to help us break all that down, Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor, and of course, my co-host, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Welcome, gentlemen, as always this morning. I've been looking forward to having this conversation with you, Eric, because there's so many legal things involved here. Supreme Court said Jean Toll, the judge who, for those of you playing along at home, there was another hearing after the Murdaugh. It was an appellate hearing, and Toll could have made the choice of, well, let's have another trial. She said, no, I don't think so. And the appeals continued to another court, which brought it to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court saying Toll put the burden on Murdaugh to prove prejudice when the law requires the opposite. So they're saying former judge looked the wrong way, put the wrong burden of proof on the wrong person, and that's why it's now taken all the way to the Supreme Court for someone to say, yeah, he really should get a new trial. Let's go back to that where this began and try to understand, how does a judge get it so backwards, or is it more of a count of accountability and not wanting to have the sticker of "I gave Alec Murdaugh a new trial" attached to her name? Where do you think that went?
Tony, you know, sometimes judges have reached a conclusion in their mind And then they conduct the legal analysis and they try to sort of tailor it and steer it in the direction of the conclusion that they've already come to. And I can't help but wonder if that was at play here. Look, Alec Murdoch was a very unpopular homicide defendant accused of killing his wife and child, convicted. And I think the judge wanted to secure that finality sort of by any legal analysis possible. And perhaps that factored into her wrongful conclusion that a new trial wasn't warranted. It clearly was. The Supremes have affirmed that.
Does it make a difference at all, ultimately, in a juror's mind, because this is going to go back to a jury at some point when we have a new trial, who made that call? Who punted it? Who said, we're going back, it's another game, we're starting over at the beginning? Does it make a difference that it wasn't Gene Toll that said that, but it was like the highest court in the land that says, this is screwed up, he deserves a new trial? Is it almost more... Does it help the defense? Does it hurt the defense? Does it do anything to the defense, judging by who is the authority figure saying, no, rules were not followed here?
Well, you know, thank heavens, Tony. That's why we have this checks and balances system, even within the judicial branch itself, whereby if a lower judge makes a wrong ruling, that is going to be scrutinized by a higher mm-hmm. court. And so the highest court in that jurisdiction determined in a flawless victory for Murdoch here. And certainly it gives them momentum. It probably lifts their spirits in terms of what this second trial could be like. And so in those senses, it does confer benefits to defense. So and then, of course, the new trial is the massive benefit.
Yeah. And I'm curious about that. So other than not having the court clerk undermine your entire prosecution because of her greed, basically, what do you think is going to be different in a second trial?
Oh, gosh, a lot of things, Robin. I think that the types of evidence that the prosecution can present, the Supremes were rather critical of some of those categories of evidence. They think the prosecution went overboard on the financial crime stuff, which is oftentimes a ground on which these convictions are reversed. I saw it from the very beginning that, hey, they're doing too much other acts evidence with the financial stuff, not focusing enough on the homicide trial. So that's going to be a lot different. We might see some different defenses from Murdoch as well. So things the game can really change here during round two.
So go ahead, Tony.
And I want to get into the details, of what's going to change here, what's going to be different in our next segment. So I want to dive into that there. But Hill never explicitly told jurors, that Murdaugh was guilty. That's important to note. Obviously, Becky Hill is who I'm talking about. She was the clerk of court where all of this is, surrounding on the genesis of Murdaugh retrial, number two here. She said, don't be fooled. Watch his movements. Don't let the defense confuse you. The court said that was functionally the same as directing a verdict. Does this ruling, does the actions of the clerk of court, does this, are the effects of this going to be felt in every courtroom in South Carolina where you may kind of have a more of a good old boy way of doing things? Well, it's how we do it over here. We do it like this. There's a little more fast and loose with the rules. Do you think that this kind of puts all those places on a bit of notice of, yeah, we can't really operate like that anymore?
In other words, how common is Becky?
Yeah. I think it surely sends that message because, look, in some of these more rural jurisdictions and smaller jurisdictions, everybody knows everybody oftentimes. And, there's conversations that are had when the court's on a break, when the jury is leaving for lunch and the court clerk's escorting them out. It's not complete silence, right? So I think this is sort of a warning to everybody who works for the government on these cases that, hey, you cannot even to the slightest degree exert any sort of influence over these cases. And if you do, we're gonna run it back, and it's gonna be, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to do this again. And also, you know, the victims' families in other cases are going to be prejudiced by it. So yeah, I think it's a strong message.
What do you think the likelihood of them switching venues is going to be?
I think certainly something the defense is going to request. And I think the likelihood is reasonably high, because they're going to say, not only does everyone in this smaller jurisdiction know about this case and probably has views about this case based on what they heard in the media, but on top of that, you know, there was just so much misconduct that took place within this jurisdiction. It is sort of soiled forever in that sense with respect to this case. And defense is going to say, hey, that's why we got to take it somewhere else, completely brand new jurisdiction.
Now, I'm curious too, Eric. The first thing, and Tony, I apologize if I'm jumping ahead on a segment. I'm not quite sure. So the first thing I looked up when I saw this hit the news wire was, all right, oh my God, is he still going to stay in jail? And yeah, because it doesn't impact, at least on the surface yet, what he pled to on the financial crime side, which again, if that stands, will keep him in jail for the rest of his life unless he becomes immortal in some way. And so does this impact that at all? Or is he still most likely staying behind bars forever? Or is that going to impact that sentencing or even that trial?
I don't anticipate this ruling having a direct impact on the other financial crimes cases, convictions, or sentences. I'm just not sure that defense is going to be able to tie this misconduct within this homicide trial to, you know, a guilty plea that resulted in decades in prison. But stranger things have happened. You know, there could be some creative litigation.
I was wondering that too, because I mean, yeah, it was a totally separate trial, but Murdaugh, that trial happened after the murder trial. And that being said, the reason for Alec Murdaugh pleading guilty in that case, I think one could argue, was because of all of the financial crimes that were exposed in the criminal murder trial, that it was like, yeah, there's no way around this. Like you have to now plead guilty. I mean, you don't have to, but I mean, there's not really a path forward. And the Supreme Court here is saying you can still introduce some of the financial stuff in trial number two, but 12 days was excessive. So you gotta reel that in a little bit. I don't know if there's a mechanism for it, but is there any mechanism where one could say, yes, he did in fact plead guilty, Your Honor, and obviously the evidence shows the fuck that he did, but is there any world where that could be reversed because of the errors of trial number one, which then influenced his decision to plead guilty for this other trial, the financial crimes trial? Is there a road there? Is there a road to say, yes, but for this decision, I wouldn't have done this, and then, you know, these dominoes wouldn't have fallen either. I don't know. I mean, is there?
I was curious about that, too, just because it seems so strategic when they did that and played on that one. It's like, do they know something we don't know of what they're going to try to do and what they probably are going to do? So I'm right with you on that question, Tony.
Very astute observation, and some creative attorneys could get creative on that front. You know, they could essentially argue, hey, when he pled guilty to the financial crimes, it was based on these circumstances, including that all of the financial crimes evidence, most a lot of it had come in during the homicide trial, and he was convicted in the homicide trial, and he's going to go to prison forever. So, gosh, why not throw in the towel and just try to move forward? But the circumstances on which that decision was based have materially changed. A person who is now not condemned for the rest of their life to spend it in prison based on a homicide conviction, that's gone. And so he might think he was wrongfully convicted on the homicide front, but you know, I'm going to be in prison forever, so I might as well plead guilty to these things. Well, now I'm not going to be in prison forever necessarily, based on the new trial in the homicide case. And so could that be grounds for withdrawing a plea on the on the financial crimes? It's sort of circuitous and attenuated, but a defense attorney might make that argument.
Wouldn't they argue, though, like with so many things, that, well, if he was not guilty, he had to at least try to argue that, you know, like we see it, you know, with the Delphi situation right now, where they're going through the appeals and it's like, well, that should have been argued earlier. You can't necessarily go back and bring this up now. That certainly, I think, would be an argument here. But I'm just wondering, has anything like that ever happened in the past? Have you ever seen a case where, okay, A plus B happened over here, and then they made their decision for game number two this way based on the findings of that game, but that game's now ruled invalid, so those choices, they're all up in the air. I mean, you can't go back in time. Has this ever happened, anything like this?
You know, no similar case comes to mind that is in this type of a posture. And look, when it comes to guilty pleas, buyer's remorse is not a good enough reason to withdraw a guilty plea.
Buyer's
remorse.
You know,
I'm looking it up right now too.
At the time, and you know, now you're kicking yourself for making that decision. That's not going to be enough. But is a substantial change in circumstances? You know, he might argue to the court that, hey, we pled guilty on the financial stuff because the whole world already saw the alleged evidence supporting it. I'm going to get convicted no matter what. But the whole world shouldn't have seen that evidence. It wouldn't have colored the impressions of future jurors. And therefore, we want another go round at this financial crime stuff, too. It's at least possible.
I'm looking it up. I'll tell you when it comes in.
What about Becky? Let's talk about Becky with the good hair. wait, that's not the right Becky. This Becky Hill, obviously, she's had her own charges against her. One count of obstruction of justice, one count of perjury, two counts of misconduct in office. She pled guilty to those charges in 2025. Now that the Supreme Court has really come through and said, yeah, you really effed up royally, Becky, we have to now give Alec Murdaugh a new trial and the millions of dollars that is going to cost the state, everything involved in this. Where does that leave Becky? I mean, is there new exposure for Becky now that the Supreme Court has gone this far? Is there exposure for her on various levels, any level? What are your thoughts, Eric?
There is. In most jurisdictions, a civil tort, so a civil claim called abuse of process, it's usually brought against prosecutors or police who are misusing the judicial system to wrongfully harm somebody. Could that apply to a court clerk who, you know, stuck her nose in this whole thing and messed up two homicide convictions? And if so, who would bring that claim? Would it be Murdaugh? You know, that would be an unusual course of action, but I think it's at least possible that there could be additional exposure on that front. And also her reputation's completely ruined for the rest of her life.
And another thing, just ruining her reputation more, does it make any sense to sue her civilly if there's not much to collect? I'm sure there's probably not a lot left, much left, if there ever was anything to begin with from the, you know, the book, the book that she lifted from others. So there's probably not a lot there to take. It doesn't make any sense other than on a principle type way of looking at this.
You know, getting really into the legal weeds on this, but Becky Hill was she might not be collectible. She might not have any significant assets, but she was working in the course and scope of her employment for the government. Now, if you bring a claim against the government, they have qualified immunity, but usually qualified immunity doesn't stand if the governmental official violated a statutory or constitutional law. And if Becky Hill deprived Murdaugh of a fair trial, that's violating his constitutional rights, which might be able to sidestep the qualified immunity piece.
So they could sue Colleton County, basically.
But potentially.
For having, because she's their employee. So it's like a company being sued because a bad employee does something bad.
Culpability for their lack of training and their execution of their training and what they're really expecting to do. And also on the lookup, the likelihood of him being able to withdraw that plea is like slim to none.
There's an interesting thought. Colleton County may end up paying Alec Murdaugh.
Well, if you think about it, again, I don't know, like Eric does, the law on this, but, you know, it's like when the ship goes down, the captain's blamed, you know, so
yeah.
So if you're not going to go after her because there's nothing to gain, you know, and if you want to really, because you could actually say, I want to just change the system. I want to ensure the system's operating fairly so it's not looking like retribution against Becky, but you want to go against the system that created a Becky to prevent other Beckys from happening. That, you know, I think that resonates more with a public as well than it would be going against, you know, greedy Becky.
Yeah, I mean, I see like the comments like Hill should be paying for the prosecution. Hill doesn't have the money to pay for the prosecution. Like,
I think she sold like 5 books before it got shut down.
Even when you are a popular author, it's usually not like get rich quick schemes here. Like,
no.
There's not a lot of money in books.
No.
So, I mean, just I don't think people are aware of that. Like, feel like you have a book, you must make like no, it doesn't pay well. So, I mean, I'm wondering, yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thought of just of where this may land. Wouldn't it be great if she shows up in the courtroom just as an observer of Alec Murdaugh trial number two? Maybe she can sell like taquitos out front or something exciting to a little stand, you know, like Becky's hot dogs and more. You know, she also sells and more. And the more actually is brakes. She says she does brake jobs for people. So you can bring up your car, they'll replace your brakes, you get a hot dog, and then you go in and watch it.
I know it's digressing, but that's what you do as these state and government employees. Years ago, before they actually adjusted the cost of living and adjustments in New York, there was an agent in the New York City field office that during the day and on weekends, he had a hot dog cart attached to the back of his bureau vehicle. So he's selling hot dogs because the salaries are so low.
And that's so disturbing. When you've told me these stories, I'm like, oh my God.
I had side hustles to sell and used books on Amazon so I could get enough money so I could pay my sources not to take them out to lunch.
And you're a great, motivated, ethical human being, and you did it all. You know, but what about those folks who aren't motivated, aren't ethical?
Robert Hansen.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, holy shit. Like, this could go sideways really quick. Anyway, yeah, your thoughts.
We digress.
In the comment section on Substack and YouTube, I'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. The Supreme Court didn't just reverse Alec Murdaugh's conviction. It told the next trial court exactly where the first one went wrong on evidence. The financial crimes testimony has been flagged as excessive and unfairly prejudicial, but some of it can come back. How much? And whether what remains is enough to carry the motive theory. That's the fight at the retrial. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, is with myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. As we break down everything that's now happened in the nuclear detonation, that is the case of Alec Murdaugh, the court said not all members would have admitted the financial evidence at all if they'd been the trial judge. If you're the new judge reading that, what's the signal? I mean, the new judge doesn't. It's up to the judge. It's not up to the Supreme Court what gets admitted in the new trial. They punted it down to the circuit court, which will now set the new rules if there's a new trial, all of that, and the standards for it. The Supreme Court, it's a recommendation, but it is just that. It is a recommendation. The judge can keep it in, can exclude it entirely, can add a little bit, just hold a tighter leash. What are your thoughts here on the financial crimes aspect of this case, and where do you think it's going to be intermingled, if at all, in Alec Murdaugh murder trial number two?
Basics, Tony, are that when a person is on trial for X, like Murdaugh here is on trial for homicide, and then the prosecution tries to bring in evidence of Y, evidence of other crimes, other acts, that can often lead to reversals, because the idea is that the jury might, you know, focus on the uncharged conduct, the conduct regarding financial crimes, and say, hey, this guy's a scoundrel, and maybe the prosecution didn't totally meet their burden on homicide, but I hate this guy, and I'm going to convict him anyway. There's the specter of that. So I think the trial judge in the new trial is going to be very cautious about that. He or she has already got direction from the Supreme Court that if you screw this piece of it up, this is probably how we're going to rule. So so don't do that. So I think that the trial judge would be prudent to substantially curtail the financial crimes evidence. You got to let the prosecution put on some evidence of motive. This is their motive, whether the jury believes it or not. It's a different question. But I think it's going to be substantially curtailed, like maybe half a day or something of evidence would be a smarter move on behalf of this judge. We don't want a Murdoch round three.
Yeah, his motive of the financial aspect of it, I think, was also exasperated by his drug use during this entire period of his life as well. And it wasn't, it was covered, but not hugely extensive. So if you remove the ability to you know, show motive as being the financial side, and given what's left behind, what are you thinking about how the prosecution moves forward? And what do you think they're going to be able to use for, you know, going after Murdaugh again, even though there's no other suspect, there's no another anything, the weapon is the weapon. They have, you know, so it's, but they're not showing the intent if they have to remove the financial aspect.
You know, Robin, I might be in the minority on this, and this might be an unpopular opinion, but I thought that there were significant weaknesses, even in trial one. And now the prosecution is going to be more handcuffed in trial two. They're going to have to prove this motive that, hey, because his finances were in peril, he killed his wife and his son. Like, there's a disconnect there. There's a non sequitur there. And so I think the prosecution is going to have an even more difficult time. I am not wholly convinced we're going to see a conviction around two.
Yeah, because what do you do when you – when I mean, because they're going to have to shift. If they can't admit any of the financial stuff, then they got to shift the entire motive as to the reason why he committed these crimes. And yeah, from what everything else – I mean, you could put, you know, maybe psychotic break because of drug abuse. But, you know, it's like you said, it's a tall, challenging order. And again, can they do that? I mean, I guess they can, but they're going to have to kind of shift up their entire game plan, aren't they?
Yes, they can, and I think they're going to have to based on these limitations on the Supreme Court.
Wow. I mean, a lot of what they did in trial one, what Creighton Waters did, I mean, you can speak to this far more than anybody could here. Is he educated a jury on a concept they were unfamiliar with, on like just a principle of how some people operate, and that would be familicide. Family annihilator is the term that I think a lot of people heard for the first time in this trial. How difficult is that? I mean, to not only you have your job number one is to try and convince a jury of your side of the story to begin with concepts they're already familiar with, but to somehow interject a concept of a human being capable of doing these sort of things that's wrapped around ideas like, he was in financial trouble, so he decided to kill his family. That doesn't register with a lot of people. But when you really get into the nitty-gritty of the familial side and the psychology of it, I get it. But I've been sitting here studying it and learning it, and it's not the average juror that's able to kind of wrap your mind around it. How difficult is that as an attorney to try and convince a jury of a concept they are completely unfamiliar with of human behavior?
You know, one quasi-analog to that, Tony, I think, or at least one way to look at it, is in the context of domestic violence victims sometimes do not report. Sometimes there's a latent outcry. It takes a while for them to report it. Sometimes when they report it, then they recant. Then they say, hey, look, I was actually making that stuff up. That didn't happen, when there is substantial evidence that it did. And so as a prosecutor, what I would have to do is you know, this jury would say, gosh, if the alleged victim's saying it didn't happen now, like that's it, intuitively, I'm probably going to go along with that. But we had to educate them using a domestic violence expert on this phenomenon that, hey, this actually happens in domestic violence scenarios. Either they don't report it or there's a cycle of abuse. They go back to the abuser and they recant. And these things happen. That doesn't mean the case is invalid. So it's really sort of smashing the preconceived notions the jury might have regarding these issues and establishing them anew with your experts if you can be persuasive in doing so.
You know, I think one of the greatest challenges the prosecution is going to have because of the familiar side on this one, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this, Eric, about whether defense is going to roll him out more in this one because of not being able to use financial crimes as much, and that's Buster. It's hard to show a familiar side. I would think, again, I'm just doing my conjecture, my behavior side, of showing that he has an intent to kill family members, except one. I mean, so I and Buster's been very, very outspoken in support of his father, and more so even afterwards, I think. So even it, because, you know, again, from the limited things you see on social media with him, he looks to be unhinged sometimes with his anger. What could actually could play very, very well for countering any mental state Murdaugh might have been in to commit familicide, because you still left one.
Right. And I think if I'm defense, maybe I even call Buster as a witness.
That's what I was thinking.
To show Murdaugh's character for peacefulness, if they can establish that.
Right.
Because they'll say, hey, this family annihilator nonsense, this is my dad, and I've known him my whole life, and he has been peaceful and gentle and loving towards us. There was a horrible tragedy that took place, but he is not a family annihilator. And I think coming from the son's mouth, the living son's mouth, could be really compelling to a jury.
Yeah.
I think Buster is a wild card in this whole damn thing.
I do too.
Because I think because he could be used easily by the prosecution and he could be easily used by the defense. It all depends where Buster's landing currently in his view of his dad. He hasn't been super vocal. He's kind of just wanted to move on with his life, you know, and the attention that he's gotten from this and all the horrid accusations that have been thrown at him. He's just kind of wanted to, you know, go live a life outside of this Murdaugh land. But I don't know where he sits today. And after it's been a little while since Murdaugh's been convicted. I don't know. I'm not speaking for him, but he may have come to the conclusion his dad did this and he's the fucking monster that he is.
The leakage I saw actually had him supporting his dad. That's what I'm going to double check right now.
There wasn't much leakage. There's just not a lot. That's the thing.
Right.
You know, that's why I don't know where he sits or stands. And after some time, opinions change. And that's what I wonder. I don't know if Buster would be on his dad's side or if he'd be on the side of the prosecution to keep him away. I mean, that's going to, I don't know. I just don't know where he's going to land. I don't think he's publicly said where he's landing right now. I just think he wants out of the spotlight, period.
Haven't heard from him in a while.
But it would be interesting to see where he lands. And that certainly, I think, would be...
He believes his dad's innocent.
Well, if that keeps up, then he's a boon
not,
to
he's not
the
happy
defense.
About the ruling.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll you keep talking. I'm gonna.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting where he plays into this, if at all. Let's talk about what we were talking about earlier with the folks of like having an expert come in and talk about. Talk about what familicide is, about family annihilator, expert witness. I'm sure you could find somebody lovely that could speak well on it. There's a huge difference between an expert witness that's not emotionally tied to the case, giving you their expert opinion, versus having Tony Satterfield's brother, who's a vulnerable adult who has some issues, you know, being in there and taking the stand too. An example of look at this vulnerable person here who lost their mother. This is who he's stealing from. I mean, that's a hell of a lot more of an emotional tie to the damage that Alec Murdaugh was doing, allegedly, versus just, and here's Carissa from New Jersey, who studied this forever and can fill you in on this. I mean, one, you are seeing the results, one, you're being told about the results. How do you think that plays in this case? And how far can the prosecution reach in to that bag of tricks, if you will, or damaged human beings by Alec Murdaugh is really what it is, and present them on the stand if the financial information is going to be limited in this case?
Yeah, I think there are upsides and downsides to what are called blind expert witnesses. Expert witnesses who have no association with the case. Oftentimes, they haven't even reviewed case records. They're just talking about intellectual, sometimes scientific concepts. So the upside is that, hey, she has no dog in this race. She's got no interest in this. She's just coming, telling you what the research says, according to her, on the prosecution. That can be attractive. On defense side, I love those experts because I say, you know, hey, have you talked with Alec Murdoch? Have you ever met him? Have you ever spoken on the phone? How about with Buster? You know, were you at their dinner table when they were celebrating this like really cool family event? And Alec Murdoch was saying how much he loved his family. You know, and were you there when he was at their high school graduation and things like that? And you say, hey, you have no connection to this. You have no idea the dynamics that are going on within this family. Your entire opinion is bullshit.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I look at it, so Buster, from what I've been seeing, is been still defending his dad as being the killer, but also did state that he's definitely manipulative, he's definitely a psychopath from his standpoint, but not a killer. So he's basically saying he's got the characteristics of a killer without being a killer.
It sounds like Buster not wanting to accept his daddy.
Yeah, so like you were saying earlier, Tony, he could be used by either defense or prosecution. So if defense wants to go down, and it's, you know, human behavior is not a bag of tricks. It's good. Mm-hmm. You know, so if that's all you have left, though, he could actually set it up well on the prosecution side, saying, hey, here's the observed behavior without his conclusion. And here's actually, independent science saying what this is capable of. Again, but just because someone's capable of it doesn't mean they did it. Mm-hmm. So they still have a long leap to go, I would think, Eric. Yes.
Yeah. And I think that, like you all said, Buster is such a wild card that if he were to get up there for the defense and say, hey, my dad is a character for peacefulness. He's never done something like this. I don't think he did this. The prosecution could say, hey, didn't you say that he was a psychopath? Didn't you say he was manipulative? Can't manipulative people change the impressions of other individuals, especially of people they love? Couldn't those sort of dynamics be at play? Couldn't that have affected, your testimony earlier in terms of how you were singing the praises of your father? So yeah, total wild card.
Yeah, he is a wild card. You're right. It really highlights what a wild card he would be. You don't know where he's going to go.
Let me ask you this, because since we're talking about the financial stuff here in this segment and the question of what's going to be admitted, I know the thought process in some ways is, 12 and a half days of financial information for a crime that's not about financial crimes is seemingly a bit excessive. And the Supreme Court said so as well. Quantity doesn't always equal quality. A good prosecutor could get in there and summarize this sometimes in an even more powerful way than a monotonous 12-day meandering testimony from a string of people. I mean, one is like, see? Yeah, just one after another. See how bad he is? See how bad he is? See how bad he is? See? Could they turn this around and really, get down to the condensed version of it and make it far more powerful in a shorter period of time than a longer period of time if it is admitted? Do you really need 12 days to make that point?
That is so the preferred approach, in my opinion. Look, these jurors, these are just regular people. They didn't sign up for this. They're sitting here for weeks on end. People's attention spans are just not exceptional. They might be worse in modern society. So having a succinct, compelling presentation is seriously important. And one thing too, Tony, is that now that there have been convictions on the financial crimes, unless those convictions are somehow undone, perhaps the prosecution just goes that route and says, hey, it's not us just telling you that he engaged in financial misdeeds. A court has already certified that he had because he admitted it. And so, that can truncate, a days long presentation into a very small summary that could have a lot of sting for this jury.
Already been convicted on those things. That's true as of right now. Could they launch anything between now and then a new trial? A new trial is going to be a bit down the road. It's not going to be happening next week. What if they start to contest that shit before the trial? That would be a powerful thing to say of like, yes, and he has been convicted, but he's but it's all being contested. It's a contested. I mean, that lands a little different than convicted if you're throwing it in front of a jury and they don't have all the context.
100%. In fact, I think strategically, so long as they have ethical grounds to do so, they should be challenging those financial crimes convictions now, because that you're exactly right. At the trial, if you know, it's not a final conviction if there's still appellate processes going on. So defense can say, hey, this is not a final conviction. And you know what? You know the reason that he entered that guilty plea? It's because Becky Hill coerced this jury into convicting him of something he didn't do. And he felt he had no other option. Let's talk about Becky Hill, too. So it could open up a whole can of worms that could give the defense even more traction.
He was just trying to be nice and not put people through a long, drawn-out trial because he thought he was already... It's a good Alec. The Alec everybody knows here in the low country. He was just trying to be a good old boy, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, so what do you think the prosecution might do then? I mean, because I keep looking this up and I keep racking my brain too. Where do you go if they completely say you can't introduce any financial motivation whatsoever? Because everything was about sympathy, because it distractions from his financial stuff. Is there anything left from what you saw before?
Kind of like you alluded to, Robin, ongoing drug abuse of very serious hard drugs can affect a person's psychological processes. They can become paranoid. They can begin to act out. They can become violent. They can become angered. All of those things, perhaps they have to rely more upon that potential precursor to all of this and less on the financial crimes. But even then, you know, a lot of people who use drugs aren't often their wife and kid. So that might be a big ask as well.
It's a big ask for beyond reasonable doubt. And do you see that as potentially happen that they could rule out everything financial? Without being into 12 days, I mean, you without that, there's like nothing.
Or is there, right?
I think with this ruling, there's a chance they could keep all of it out. I think it's more likely they're going to say, hey, prosecutor, you get to present some evidence of your motive, and that's this financial piece. But that evidence is going to be very circumscribed. And so that might be the ultimate trial ruling for a trial two.
Right.
So many questions. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation there. There's more here. The retrial is not going to be a rerun. The evidence... in the Alec Murdaugh retrial, the rules have changed. Becky Hill has a criminal conviction. 3 years of additional proceedings have produced material that didn't exist when the first jury deliberated, but the state has advantages too, including every word Murdaugh said on the stand. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, is with myself and Robin Drake breaking down all of this as we discuss what the new Murdaugh trial might look like. One of the people who I'm very interested in hearing more of her story, she's been on the show, she's talked about it, it's Blanca Simpson. That was Murdaugh's housekeeper who was there the day after everything happened. She was in there, she noticed, this is odd, Maggie's pajamas are put out in the laundry room. Like, she doesn't do that. That's not something Maggie ever did. Maggie's car is moved, and the seat is way back, like someone larger went in there and moved the seat. She also talks about a white truck that was mysteriously on the property that day that a lot of people didn't talk about. There's allegations of an officer that was not part of the local authority, but was there kind of by happenstance, by chance, because somebody's vehicle broke down and then they gave a ride to some other officers to get out there. And then this person happened to be there and that person happened to get a $5,000 check from Alec Murdaugh shortly thereafter. And it was to supposedly be a loan to his parents. There's a lot of weird shit that went on around this case. That was never litigated, that was never in this, that does potentially point to other people involved. Blanca Simpson even has said it so much so on this show of something to the effect of she believes Alec is responsible, but she does believe that there were essentially fixers or something of that nature, people who would come in and kind of clean up Alec's mess, if you will. So there seems to be a lot of other pieces here that haven't really been thoroughly investigated, and I feel like they could go in any direction. It depends who, I guess, grabs them out of the claw machine first. What are your thoughts on all this? I mean, might we see a very different trial with very different motives and very different theories being brought to light?
Oh, I think there are going to be substantial changes. And I think the defense would be well served to try to continue to work up this alternative suspect theory that there was someone else involved here. And perhaps these sort of curious, suspicious, unusual observations by the housekeeper and others might go towards that theory. And in fact, you know, if that stuff wasn't thoroughly investigated at the time that this happened, you know, Alec Murdoch's counsel can ask the cops on the stand, hey, like, did you do DNA testing on Maggie's clothes that were left out when she would never leave them out like that? Did you do DNA testing on her vehicle that appeared to have the seat pushed back? Did you look into any of that to try to determine who did this, or had you already decided it must have been Alec? You know, there are ways that this could really blow up based on these new developments, and things could really change in the second trial.
Yeah, do you think, you know, from the viewpoint of the jurors, even though they're not supposed to have any former knowledge of the other case and everything, you know, the likelihood is slim to none. If the prosecution introduces a whole new set of theories and motives based on new information like this, do you think that from the standpoint of not just public, but really the jurors, does that undermine the credibility of the prosecution, you think? Does it cause even more doubt, or should they try to double down in some way on what they already had?
I've seen cases, Robin, where the prosecution's theory and theme in the first trial and the theory and theme in the second trial are almost completely different. And so but the thing is, the jury in the second trial wouldn't hear about that. They wouldn't hear that the prosecution changed their tune and are thinking that this happened in an entirely different way or for an entirely different reason the second go around. So jury's not going to hear about that unless they have prior knowledge of the case.
Right, which is hard.
All the more reason for changing venue.
Yeah.
What about Alec? Let's talk about anything that was said in that first trial. Alec on the stand specifically, the snot show and all. It was like a sprinkler of snot.
You showed that picture the other day. I almost died. Yeah. Bad imagery.
It was a snot sprinkler. And I was watching Corey Richards this morning doing hers, and I'm like, she needs more snot. She really needs to murder all this. And 5 minutes later, we had snot. I just want to say bravo. I mean, that was a nice little nod there to Alec, Corey. I know you didn't really mean to do that.
Snorting pepper from the the prison. From the prison cafeteria. That's what they're doing.
So the question is, obviously, the snot show. Eric, what can any of that come into play here? Or is it like that never happened? Like everything that was said on the stand under oath, is it erased? It doesn't exist on the record anymore? Or, I mean, if Alec were to take the stand at this trial and say things that are different or contradictory to what he said the first time, can any of that be brought up? Or is this a clean slate?
It is likely not a clean slate on that front at all. The judge has wide discretion to determine what evidence comes in at trial, but prior sworn testimony from a defendant, I think that the likelihood that is going to come in is extremely high in favor of the prosecution. And what it does too, Tony, is it really handcuffs Murdoch's ability to change their defense, to make pivots, to make adjustments, because, like you said, if he gets on the stand in trial two and says something totally different, prosecutor is going to go, hey, play the tape where you said the exact opposite of that, and you're crying to this jury trying to get their emotions involved to get sympathy for you. And so that's one peril of a defendant testifying. If there is a retrial, that testimony is usually set in stone, and defense can't really deviate from that.
You know, it'd be really interesting, because we haven't heard of any jailhouse calls or visits that Murdoch's had, at least that I've seen. And I would really wonder about the types of things and who he said them to after he's convicted behind bars, not knowing that this was going to happen. Or maybe he was, you know, hoping this was going to happen, so he kept shut up. So I really wonder if there's going to be his own leakage that might undermine him as well.
Yeah, no, I think, this prior testimony and then anything that's happened subsequent to that, the prosecution, I'm sure, has interns reviewing hours and hours of jail calls. I've had to do it before. It's arduous. But yes, that's being done, I'm sure.
Proving reasonable doubt is the goal. And that's all they have to do. They don't have to come up with a reason. They don't have to come up with a reason the first time. Might they want to come up with something this time? Might they want to present? The housekeeper even saw that white truck out here on the property. Yeah, they didn't test this or that, because there's a lot of incompetency that did happen on the investigation. And a lot of it, I think, was initially, in my opinion, to benefit Murdaugh, to be like, oh, we're not going to be intrusive on you. We know you didn't do, you know, it was they were looking at him not necessarily with suspicion, I feel like, right off the bat. And for whatever reason, because it still doesn't make a lot of sense. Well, if you don't think it's him, then why the hell are you not testing all these things, these door handles, all these places that would make sense to be looking at? So incompetence is a big thing in this trial. How much do you think they're going to lean into the police investigation or the gazillion missteps which took place in this and say, see, reasonable doubt. If they'd only done their job fully, we might have a better picture, but we don't and we can't. So you got to let them go.
Right. You know, and that can be a very compelling argument, especially, you know, I think in our modern culture, there's a little bit more, I don't know if skepticism is the right word, but people don't just completely accept what law enforcement says as gospel and, oh, they must have done everything right. And they're always the good guys. I think that folks are seeing it a little differently now. And that can go a long ways at a jury trial. And I think that, like I said, defense really has to come up with some plausible alternative. Who else could have done this? Is it that weird Eddie guy and that, like, you know, fake suicide insurance scam thing? Is it somebody from Paul's boating incident where he killed somebody when he was drunk, allegedly? And I think they've got to crystallize that piece a little bit more, add it to law enforcement incompetence. That could be a recipe for reasonable doubt.
And I mean, one of the things that can really back up that, and I'm not trying to give the Murdaugh team any sort of ammunition here, but Blanca Simpson has made the statement after all of this that when she went to law enforcement and was trying to tell them the stories of what she had witnessed, the things she told us, she's told many other people, she told in her book, they told her, allegedly, according to her, to seek mental health help. Not like, this is really tough, I hope you get some help, you know, to help deal. Like, more like, go get some mental, you're crazy, you got to go, you know, that sort of way is the way she alleges it was said. So it's like, ooh, that might not land well with a jury where you're like, hey, I'm the housekeeper, I know these people pretty well, probably more than most human beings. I have valuable information and the police told me to go see a shrink. That doesn't necessarily land well with a jury in terms of evaluating a thorough investigation.
That could almost be a linchpin for the defense, in my appraisal. Look, especially when we're talking about possible alternative suspects. Hey, you've got somebody who's so proximal to this family, so proximal to this situation, who made some unusual observations. And instead of following up on those, you told her, hey, it sounds like you're crazy. And had the police followed up on that, maybe they would have found the real killer, according to Murdaugh. I think that that just sort of crystallizes the alleged failures on behalf of law enforcement to thoroughly try to determine who else may have been involved and could be really compelling a trial.
Yeah, I see her definitely as a linchpin just because of the proximity and the objectivity she seems to have in it, the way she's presenting it, because she is, you know, daily contact, routine contact, close proximity. And and she's not a family member. And the fact that she's able to be so cognitive and objective in her observations without much motive, it looks like. So, you know, there's gains from, you know, from notoriety, but not to the extent of being willing to put yourself out there. So under a microscope. So, yeah.
It will be fascinating. Blanca is going to be here on the show in the coming weeks. I don't have the exact date yet, but we've been talking, and it'll be interesting to get her reaction as to all this. I know right now she's in shock about shock. Knew she knew it was coming, you know. But no matter what, sometimes even when you know, it hits you. It hits you hard.
What's shocking, you think, to her?
I don't know. I mean, just. I knew it was going to happen. I think we all kind of, I had a feeling it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. But when it did happen, even I was like, wow, is this happening?
Yeah.
I think it's just kind of that, where you know it's coming. I mean, I was rooting for it to happen, not because I want to talk about Alec Murdaugh for the next 3 years. I mean, it's good for business, but
because here's what I'm really curious about. You know, it's not just from her, because I know there's been a lot of people saying I'm shocked by this. And it's an interesting emotion to explore, only because if the shock is because of fear, it would be really prudent, I think, for people to understand from those people that are most shocked, if it's because of fear of what? And so being able to drill that down might give prosecution some more to really leverage and go on, because if people are in fear that it's overturned, and even the glimmer of possibility he has more of an impact back in the community again, I mean, if that's having ripples of fear, I think really drilling down on that's important.
Yeah. No, I'd agree. I agree. I don't know what the cause. I think it's probably a different shock for different people, depending on how they're related to the case, honestly. Your thoughts in the comment section. Are you shocked that this is happening? Never say never.
Actually, that's a final question for you, Eric. So had it not been for Becky Hill, do you think that they would have been still overturned like this because of the financial stuff, or was it just Becky alone?
I think there's a high likelihood, Robin. Those other acts, evidence, putting forth evidence of alleged crimes that are not charged in a case, makes a dude look totally bad, could color a jury's perception. Courts, appellate courts, are really wary of those. So I think it's a reasonable likelihood it would have been overturned, even absent Becky.
Wow. Okay. With or without Becky.
Yeah, I'll throw her a little sliver of grace on that one.
There you go,
right?
Becky. Might have happened either way.
I gave you a hairpin.
But just know it mainly happened because of you. So have that with your coffee. There you go. All right, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. We'll continue the conversation right there. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books. Go check it out. And Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here and giving us your insight, as always. Until next time, for Eric, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski and Robin Dree.
It's been an eventful week in terms of cases, what's going to be happening, what people are saying once they've been convicted, and we're going to be talking about that. Alec Murdaugh being the top of the list, Corey Richens sentencing, we're going to get to that as well. But let's start with old Alec Murdaugh, because we are back at literally square one. Welcome back to 2021, 2022, somewhere around there. That's about where we've been placing ourselves at now, because Alec Murdaugh is now an alleged murderer. He is not the convicted murderer of his wife and son. Retrial, very likely going to be coming down the pike at some point this year, next year, following year. I don't know. We'll get to all of that. But it's going to be a very, very different trial than trial number one. And somebody who holds the key to the future of Alec Murdaugh and what his legacy will be, what the history books say about him, whether or not he's a murderer or just a financial fraudster, is his very own son, Buster Murdaugh. He sat behind his father every day of that first trial, told the jury he didn't believe his dad could do this. Then Alec got convicted and Buster vanished, and rightfully so. This is not an episode. I have nothing negative to say about Buster. Buster is a victim of his father and a victim of his family. He also holds a lot of cards here based on what he expresses in terms of if he believes his father killed his brother and his mother. He's been married. He quietly moved on. But Buster, if he still believes his father, he's the most powerful witness the defense has. If he doesn't, the prosecution just found someone who can look the jury in the eye and say Alec Murdaugh is capable of killing his own family. Here to discuss on Friday, as always, a great panel for us. Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, and Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, host of the podcast Break the Case. Be sure to check it out on YouTube and wherever you get podcasts. Welcome to both of you. Prosecution's theory is family annihilation. At least it was in trial one. Alec was cornered and desperate and destroyed the people closest to him. But, Jen, you, I think, have even pointed out on X that killing three is harder than killing two, and Maggie probably wouldn't have bought a story about Paul being gunned down if Buster was also dead. Does the fact that Buster is alive actually break the state's own motive theory before they even get to the opening statements, the fact that he's still alive and breathing? Is that an angle they could take this round?
I don't think really, and that's, this is why, when you look at what Buster didn't bring to the table that Pawpaw did. In other words, Paul, who he called Pawpaw, which I know was a little sick, but he had a boating accident under the influence that resulted in the death. Mm-hmm. And that death brought all sorts of not only shame to the family, but financial woes to the family. And you add on top of that, Maggie, who, again, there were no life insurance policies on anybody, but control of their estate, you know, control of what would and wouldn't be done with money. And you add that all together, and it makes sense to me that he's just not going to get away with killing all three. Although, believe me, I think he had hoped he could figure out a way to annihilate all three. He only was able to annihilate two.
Yeah, it's interesting on the Buster thing. I keep looking at different ways. And one of the things that popped in my mind when looking at Buster and his kind of, I wouldn't say chaotic responses necessarily, but he's had a lot of emotional type responses where he could be beneficial to both sides. And in my experience, and I'm wondering if this is your experience too, do you see him as a handling issue for either prosecution or defense, like we have with sources sometimes?
Yeah, it's such a great question. You know, you look at him, and I think that he definitely served the defense last time from the standpoint of you always want to look where the surviving relative, they're going to stand on things. And I don't know if we're going to see him in the same posture. I wouldn't be surprised to see him not even show up, not even be in the courtroom until subpoenaed, because he will be subpoenaed.
Yeah, I definitely am seeing him as a potential credibility issue, either that both sides could attack his credibility because of it as well. And so that's why I would be leery of introducing him on either side, because again, outside out looking in, you know, you don't know because we're not him, not close to him, but it's a kid's glove kind of time, I think, with assessing where he's actually at, and can he be consistent with what he presents, and can we actually defend him on cross from the credibility issues, I would think.
I think you're exactly right there, because if he were to take the stand, let's say in theory here, and we have no idea. Right now we know from reports allegedly that he's furious that this is happening. He's called Alec a selfish old man. And he has certainly kept his distance. We've heard some of the phone calls between him and his dad over the last couple of years from prison, Alec being in prison. And it hasn't been necessarily the loving son, father-son relationship that one may think. feels very contentious, and rightfully so. I mean, he's forever tainted by what his family has done. So if he were to take the stand, and if he were to take the stand on the part of defense, in theory, he could basically be impeached in one way or another, I would think. Or they'll certainly take a chance at impeaching his testimony from the side of Alec because of his former testimony that was pro-dad, pro-Alec. And it all depends exactly how it's presented and what is presented. But the reality is he could have, in the last 3 years, ventured to a very different conclusion than he had at that moment in time when his dad was on trial. Sitting there, the time to sit back, to look at everything. After abusive situations, after coming out of an environment that was controlled, all of that, it takes years sometimes to look back and go, oh God, that was that, was that? And you don't know it. And sometimes it's obvious things to others looking in, but not to those closest. He could have a very different opinion. Those opinions, those thoughts, those memories, when put together, if presented at trial, could paint a very different picture of Alec Murdaugh. And it could be a very powerful one. But again, yeah, is that a lever either side, you know, the defense is willing to pull, even if he's willing to do it? Because it could backfire spectacularly, could it not?
Well, first of all, to your point about it taking family and loved ones time to come around, I'm going to give you just the best analogy that I can think of, and that's Lacey Peterson. You look at Lacey's mom, I mean, she always stood up. Everybody stood up initially for Scott.
Uh-huh.
It just takes, when you love somebody, when you're there at Thanksgivings, when they're the, you know, to be father of your unborn grandson, nobody wants to believe that they could ever do these horrific crimes, right? So it makes sense to me that Buster would have supported his dad. I mean, that's the one last thing he has left. He has no mom. He has no brother. He's only got his father left, and you don't want to believe it. I believe he could be a breakout powerhouse witness for the prosecution if he has something meaningful to say. And I think that exactly how I explained why initially he was behind his dad could be used to mitigate what he said earlier.
Yeah, and I agree on the side if he decides to do the prosecution, you know, for the prosecution side and testify on that side. And I'm just looking at this pattern of behavior that we've seen since Alec was convicted and sentenced. He's pulled back, he's been restrained. And so we have a pattern of behavior of disconnected and moving on, like Tony said. And so then you got to ask, so we keep talking in terms of defense and prosecution, them using him, but now let's reverse it. What's in it for Buster to want to do this? I'm hard pressed. And the only thing I can really think of that he would get out of doing this, unless he's subpoenaed and he has to, would be if he is part of his therapeutic healing was to do something like this, which is maybe. I'm thinking he's most likely would follow his same pattern behavior that he's done. And that is, you know, he's expressed anger that this is happening. Maybe that anger, again, is conjecture, is because, God dang, I got to go through this again. I'm done. I'm moving on. You know, this guy's an ass. He's behind bars. You know, why do I got to suffer? So he might not want to do it at all on either side because he's just trying to move on, like we've been saying.
Yeah, you know, we don't know Buster, as you guys mentioned, and we don't know him. But imagine that realization, and you see this with victim family members when they realize a family member's responsible and they finally come to Jesus. They are pissed, and he might be ready to say his truth. You know, all the little signs that he had that he might just want to be ready to just come forth and then also clear his name in a sense, you know,
distance himself.
I might have cheated on, you know, some stuff in school, but remember, you know, there's that piece of it. I just think that's a character.
Possibility of rebranding. Yeah, sorry, Tony.
Yeah, I mean, and the cheating stuff. You actually reminded me of that the other day in your tweet. It took me a moment because you said the cheating stuff in parentheses, and I'm like, what is she talking about? I'm like, oh yeah, the cheating stuff at school. Because at first I thought like relationship wise, I'm like, what are we going here? And I don't know, anybody's been thinking of that anymore. Obviously, the big thing that people think about with Buster were the allegations that were made about Stephen Smith, which have been debunked, and but still, you know, forever will plague him because it's the Murdaugh name and all that. Again, I'm in no way it's saying there's anything to do with that, but it certainly is something where if he took a super strong stance against his family, I think that would be powerful. And it would probably go a long ways to go against the detractors and the people that still stand by that whole story and go, see, I think he had something to do with it. I mean, he's not going to win in every arena. There's still going to be something to go, see, he's doing this to cover it up even more. And, you know, everybody's going to have a reason for everything. But I think that would be powerful. But there's this too. And tell me what your thoughts are. It is a family name. Alec Murdaugh has Richard Alexander Murdaugh is now there's a third Richard Alexander Murdaugh, and it's Buster's kid who was born after the trial, who was born after everything. I don't want to make a deal about the kid, but the name itself, Buster felt strong enough to name his child after his father. That says something.
Well, it's a long held family name.
Yeah, but stay on your dad.
I agree with you. You know, at least make it a middle name. I don't know.
I mean, it is. It's Richard Alexander Murdaugh, but he's now Richard Alexander Murdaugh III is the child. So, I mean, I get it. Legacy is hurt, but at the same point, I don't know. Maybe break free at some point, but I don't know. Families are strong things. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it might be an indication that he will stay steadfast. Like I said, I could see him showing up in the courtroom at all, being subpoenaed by the defense and giving the same type of testimony. But you never know. People change, and he could have even changed after he had his job.
Yeah.
You know, it really comes down to what he thinks of the name, why he's choosing that name, just because he chose a name. a trap we all fall into a lot of times is what we would do in those situations. And that's one thing I enjoy in these moments is doing our best to reverse it, understand the thought process. Granted, I think it's stupid because if his intent is to distance himself from his family and break free of that name. But, you know, I mean, I know some people are heavy into genetics, heavy into genealogy, heavy into the heraldry of their name, their backgrounds, even with blemishes. And if he sees his dad as a one-time blemish, maybe he wants to hold on to that name because, like Jen said, it's a family historical type name. I don't know. Understanding that thought process, and this is what really prosecution, if they want to use him, is going to have to really deeply more understand his thought process behind that, because that's something defense could bring up as well, or who knows. So family tradition follows the Murdaugh pattern. Alex Murdaugh's full name is Richard Alexander Sr. Buster is Jr. The baby is third. Tripp is common nickname for the third. It is a family tradition.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it is after his name too. I mean, I don't want to admit that. That is part of the story. Yeah.
It's interesting. It makes you think. You know, and that's why I love, you know, the thing that popped in my mind this morning as the three of us are doing it. It's like we're doing, like we do all the time, we're doing big thought experiments on what if this, what if this, what if this, what's this mean, what's this mean, what's this mean, all these different angles to try to understand. Basically, the greatest challenge of this is how is prosecution going to move forward with a new trial and not be able to really cover it the way they did last time, using the big lever of the financial crime aspect of it? And what now? I mean, you know, you still have two dead people and someone who's now just accused of this, who it's really messy. And that's why we're talking Eric Faddish yesterday was really interesting. And I can't wait to get Bob's take on it as well. But it's a lot of messiness in here.
Yeah, the layers of messiness run very, very deep. And I should note, in the next week or two, we're going to have Alec Murdaugh's housekeeper back on with us, Blanca Simpson, get her reaction to all this. The other night, it was their camp that actually texted me before all this came down and said, by the way, this is happening. And I know Blanca, they reached out the other week and said, Can she come on when this happens? Like, yes, she can. I'm looking forward to that conversation. So we'll get some more insight from someone who was right there at Moselle when this stuff was happening.
And that could be really powerful, too.
Can we have her on a Friday with you? Maybe. I don't know. That'd be fun.
And great angles. I mean, so, you know, because this is new angles that the prosecution wasn't able to cover last time. So you have the housekeeper and you have Buster that might be on the side of the prosecutionist side. It's going to bring a whole new angle and whole new different types of testimony that it's going to really could potentially be even more damning. But again, on the personal side of Alec, and you know, the more the horrendous things going on behind it, but also could it show the pattern of behavior of escalation as well, which because again, you got to go beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, for conviction of this. So it's going to be a challenging road.
It is, no matter what. Your thoughts in the comment section, Substack, YouTube, leave them there for us, and we'll continue that conversation there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now, and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21+. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21+. Terms and conditions apply.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No